Welcome to Founders Week 1999. The theme for this year's Founders Week is a passion for souls. Let's welcome Ravi Zacharias as he comes now to share with us.
I leaned over to Dr. Stoll a few minutes ago and said to him, I really don't believe you need a sermon tonight. And I mean that sincerely. I think I've just watched my wife and daughter who are with me here enjoying the service just as I have. What a marvelous opportunity to be with you as fellow believers. And if you are a seeker, genuinely searching with the honest answers, I hope even what you have witnessed and experienced so far will really, through God Himself, have ministered to your spirit to show you the reality of the songs of souls set free. You know, the old quip used to be, if you are talking to an atheist and if you serve him a fine dinner and then ask him if he believes in a cook, I think there is a reality where if you were to bring someone who didn't believe in God to be in a setting such as this, there would be a very difficult way to explain away this kind of phenomenon. God has been so real, so present. And as for Jeffrey, I do have a proposal for you. If I give you my tan, will you give me your voice? After I finish using my voice, nobody ever says, wow. Everyone comes and offers me some throat lozenges to see if that would help. It's really such a blessing to listen to a gifted musician, and for all of you in your marvelous rendering instrumentally, thank you for lifting us into the very presence of the Lord. As I struggled with a message to be brought tonight on this theme, the passion, a passion for souls, there were many particular thoughts that went through my mind going through various biblical characters who displayed that kind of passion which ought to be emulated. I instead have taken a fundamental assumption behind all of this because at the heart of our commitment to reach out to a world is the recognition or the tacit surrender to the truth that humanity is lost outside of God. And that lostness is being manifested in such enormous and such drastic proportions that it is almost inescapable and yet not recognized by those who want to stand against God. I think it was Malcolm Muggeridge who once said that the depravity of man is the most empirically verifiable fact, but at the same time the most easily resisted truth. It is the most empirically verifiable fact and yet so easily resisted by those who do not want to bring their lives under the superintendency of God. Bishop John Reed of Australia tells a cute little story, which I think, at least from my perspective, quintessentially represents the postmodern mindset. He talks of two Australian sailors who had come into London on a foggy evening, and they went into a bar enjoying the offerings there and drinking themselves silly late into the night. When they had walked out and seen this fog become even more dense, as they were swaggering on their feet coming out of the bar room and not able to see anything, they wondered how they would ever find their way back to their hotels. And then a highly decorated English officer was walking into the bar, but they could not see the medals flashing. And one of the Australian sailors looked at him and said, "Hey, you bloke, can you tell us where we are?" And the English officer, very upset by this disrespect, leaned forward and said, "Do you men know who I am?" And then one sailor turned to the other and said, "We are really in a mess now. We don't know where we are, and he doesn't know who he is." That, to me, epitomizes what the postmodern mindset is like. We use terms like progress, but we have no way to measure what progress really is. We talk about the problem of suffering, and we talk about moral issues, but we do not know what the purpose of life itself is. You see, it is one thing to accept the fact that there is a confusion and an uncertainty, and indeed a lostness to the human scene. But it is another thing to triumphantly espouse the fact that we are not lost and it doesn't matter why we are in this world. Listen, for example, to Stephen Jay Gould, the renowned anti-theistic paleontologist from Harvard University, writing on his perspective of life's meaning. Please listen carefully. There are two or three paragraphs here. The human species has inhabited this planet for 250,000 years or so, roughly. 0.0015% of the history of life, the last inch of the cosmic mile. The world fared perfectly well without us for all but the last moment of earthly time. And this fact makes our appearance look more like an accidental afterthought than the culmination of a prefigured plan. Moreover, and more important, the pathways that have led to our evolution are quirky, improbable, unrepeatable, and utterly unpredictable. Human evolution, though, is not random. It makes sense and can be explained after the fact. But wind back life's tape to the dawn of time and let it play again, and you will never get humans a second time. We are here because one odd group of fishes had a peculiar fin anatomy that could transform into legs for terrestrial creatures. Because comets struck the earth and wiped out dinosaurs, thereby giving mammals a chance not otherwise available. So, thank your lucky stars in a literal sense. Because the earth never froze entirely during an ice age. Because a small and tenuous species arising in Africa a quarter of a million years ago has managed so far to survive by hook and by crook. We may yearn for a higher answer, but none exists. This explanation, though superficially troubling, if not terrifying, is ultimately liberating and exhilarating. We cannot read the meaning of life passively in the facts of nature. Listen now, please. We must construct these answers ourselves from our own wisdom and ethical sense. There is no other way. A categoric denial of a transcendent perspective, while superficially troubling, if you really come to grips with it, is exhilarating and truly liberating. Is that what we are witnessing around? The slaughter in Bosnia? The dying on the streets of Sierra Leone? Having come through the bloodiest century in history? No purpose, no meaning to life? We just happen to be here as a blip on the radar screen of time, an accidental collocation for which there was no prevision from any superintending being. Is that what this is all about? And once they come to this conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, there are unanswerable questions, questions that haunt, questions that they cannot shake off. For example, they raise the question of evil and suffering and pain. But I have this question for them. How does an entity that originated in a non-moral first cause, through a process of amoral happenings, end up as a moral being? Where did we get this from? What about the notion of nobility, altruism, ethics, goodness, decency? Do you know what they are finally trying to conclude on this? You may think this is so far-fetched, but I want you to know it's coming from some of the brightest anti-theistic minds of our time. Richard Dawkins, that bulldog of Darwinism, who vociferously speaks out against any religious notions. He presented a recent lecture, the Voltaire Lecture Series, and has actually gone on record as saying that those of us who have this idea of God, those who think of a transcendent perspective, ought to be compared to a software program where a virus has come into our thinking and that virus needs to be expunged. A whole lecture on this virulent infection of the human mind. And then Dawkins goes on to say, yes, we can talk about platitudes and talk about pity when we see suffering. There is nothing to this. This is exactly what our DNA has done. this is exactly what a random universe would look like. So they have no explanation for either the glory or the shame of the universe, but they stand and tell us that the message is exhilarating, the message is thrilling once we fully understand it. And then they will look at the Christian perspective and talk of it in foreboding terms. We talk of lostness. We talk of things like eternal separation from God and so on. And they mock those verities. I want to try and present to you tonight what the Bible means when it talks about us as men and women who are lost, and then give you briefly in the closing fragmentary moments what it is that the answer of Christ entails for us, and how indeed this is truly the good news impelling us with a passion to reach the lost of mankind. When I present this message on the lostness, when I began to look at it, I was trying to see how simply I could present three or four truths that would capture the essence of it. May I present them to you as I've taken them principally from the passages in Genesis and the New Testament passages, particularly in the book of Romans chapter 1. The first decision that God gives to us, reveals to us of the choice that we made, is that choice of rejection. When Adam and Eve found themselves in the garden, all pristine, all beautiful, all relationships were so splendid, that walking and talking with God Himself, looking at all the Edenic beauty that surrounded them, and then that consummate expression of love between man and woman, all that God had poured in, He said, was good. But when He framed that day in which we should rest and set aside to commune with Him, He referred to that as a day that was holy. Time was given sanctity. Life was endowed with sanctity. And He clearly revealed the purpose that He had for them, to walk and talk with God. And in that relationship horizontally, that relationship with God Himself was to make itself manifest. Now, when the temptation came, there are two very significant responses that Adam and Eve actually have as the tempter presents this challenge to them, to taste of the fruit that God had said was forbidden. The first thing Satan says to Eve is, did God really say this? Did God really say this? Think in your own heart, how many times have you paused and struggled with the same temptation? Is this really the word of God? Did God really tell you to keep your body holy and unadulterated, that it was to be used only in the consummate expression of marital love? Did Jesus really mean it when He told me that this body was His temple, that He would make His dwelling place within this mortal frame? And that temptation to doubt, did God really say, moved in then to the next challenge, and the challenge was, surely in the day that you eat of it, you will not die. First the doubt, then the transgression, and suddenly everything was dramatically changed. May I make for you five or six statements of what doctrinally represents what happened? Sin entered through Adam's transgression, number one. Death came by way of sin, number two. Sin involved the whole race, number three. This racial guilt did not destroy personal responsibility, number four. Sin and death obtained universal dominion, number five. And man is now in need of redemption. If you were to take this simple little narrative given to us right from the beginning, as God has conveyed to us what He said, what He had spoken, and the question comes, did God really say this? And ultimately the transgression follows. When you look into the heart of humanity today, now you begin to see how by rejecting His authority, we lost all points of moral reference. Listen, for example, to the words of Viktor Frankl, who died not too long ago. This man who had spent twice in concentration camps. Listen to his argument here. If we present man with a concept of man which is not true, we may well corrupt him. when we present him as an automaton of reflexes, as a mind machine, as a bundle of instincts, as a pawn of drives and reactions, or as a mere product of instincts, heredity, and environment. We will then feed the nihilism to which modern man is in any case prone. I became acquainted with the last stage of corruption in my second concentration camp, Auschwitz. The gas chambers of Auschwitz were the ultimate consequence of the theory that man is nothing but the product of heredity and environment, or as the Nazis liked to say, of blood and soil. I am absolutely convinced, says he, that the gas chambers of Auschwitz, Treblinka, and Majdanek were not ultimately prepared in some Ministry of Defense or other in Berlin, but rather at the desks and in the lecture halls of nihilistic scientists and philosophers. I hope Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Dawkins listened to those words. What happened in the Holocaust did not come about because of some Ministry of Defense theory of conquering the world militarily, but it was prepared philosophically at the desks of nihilistic scientists and philosophers. And what you and I have seen, even in our lifetime, all the tragedy, all the dishonor, all the violence, all the human indignity is actually born out of this belief that we are nothing more than the mere random collocation of atoms. But God instead tells us that there is a purpose, there is a word that is given to us, and when Adam and Eve took the first step of rejection, you begin to see how the spiral came about. Number two, first was rejection, secondly was alienation. And when you look at the concept of alienation, you begin to see the gradual distancing. Adam and Eve are now naked, and they are aware of that nakedness, and they are ashamed. There is that fascinating verse in the Old Testament. I am not sure we have fully comprehended it. You remember the tempter looked at Eve and Adam and said to them that in the day that you will eat of this, you will become as God, knowing good and evil. Now, exegetes dealing with the passage give us various options of what this must have meant. Possibly for the first time, they were going to become aware of what it was to actually experience evil. As God knew it cognitively, they knew it experientially. I'd like to suggest to you possibly there's more to it than that. I believe in the moment that they chose to reject the authority of God, they took upon themselves the prerogative of defining good and evil. They were going to play God. They were going to become the authors of their own destiny. That they would now rename everything, rebaptize everything. Rather than naming them under the sovereignty of God, they were now going to name things under their own sensual proclivities and under their own self-centered desires. Because the alienation took place in four categories. Hear me, please. Morally, sensuality ran unrestrained. Socially, violence became uncontained. Physically, disease was going to invade lives now. And spiritually, there was no longer a point of reference for meaning. They had become empty within themselves. May I repeat this for you? Morally, sensuality. Socially, violence. Physically, disease. And spiritually, there was an emptiness. I always hesitate when I address something that is so delicate, and many, many times want to back away from it, because I do not want a wearied populace to think that it is easy to hit someone who is unsteady on his feet in this matter already. And I want you to know before God, therefore, that is not the intention. We have already read so much to a point of mental fatigue in understanding the trauma of what has happened in our country over the last year or two. There has been anguish. There have been families hurt. There have been lives destroyed. I remember sitting in a hotel room with my wife in London, England, when I heard President Clinton come to the microphone where he was speaking to a group of men and women in ministry. and use the word for the first time, I have sinned. And I just want you to know, irrepressibly my eyes just filled up with tears when I heard that, because that was probably the truest representation of all that had happened. So I'm not here to try to make something awkward, even more uncomfortable for us. But I want to say this, something extraordinarily tragic has happened in a culture when educated men and women, with all of their degrees, makers of the laws of the land, can make a statement like this. This is only to do with sexuality, nothing more. Is that not serious enough? Is that not serious enough to take a woman, denude her, and use her in general terms for your satisfaction, taking away from that person her particularity? When you have traded away the sanctity of a relationship for a fleeting few moments of some kind of satisfaction and mental stimulation? Oh, the havoc that we have wreaked by losing the sanctity of sexuality. It is sacred, young people. Don't lose it. When you trade away the sanctity of sex, you've traded away one of the greatest gifts God has given to you. For in that consummate relationship between a husband and wife, that physical embrace has spiritual connotations implicit in that relationship. It is the most sacred commitment you make to another human being. And when you tell the human being all they are is a body, and move them aside so that some other body can deliver the same thrill, you have taken away the glory of what God has endowed you with of particular value. Ah, the irony of this is that it is so much easier to preach it than to live it, because the haunting reality of sensual desires stalks all of us. None of us is free from it if we are normal human beings, because we live within this physical coil, and encased within it are desires and an imagination that runs wild and is never able to deliver what actually it thinks will be delivered. But look at what we have lost in the whole area of the sanctity of the home. Look at what we have lost in terms of violence all around. I give a priority to nations that are in trouble, nations that are in distress. In my invitations, I always put right at the top of the list places where men and women are paying dearly with their lives. I was in Vietnam while only in my 20s, preaching to the American soldiers and amongst the Viet Cong and amongst the Vietnamese prisons and their hospitals and so on, because of my passion for places where life had been so devalued. And just this week, as I was watching on the news, what was happening in Sierra Leone, men and women who look like nobody really cared for them, being shot in some kind of tribal warfare, put between two metal sheets and carried away into mass graves. I was literally working out in my exercise looking at this, and it was so hard to contain the emotions. Is this what you wanted this man to look like, God, when you fashioned us? Of course not. But alienation has separated us not only from God, but separated us even from those whom we love, and separated us from our fellow human beings. I have occasionally used this, and so if you're familiar with this, please forgive me for it. But I remember on one occasion sitting across a restaurant, at a table having lunch with John DeLorean, whose life at one time was so promising. He was the fair-haired boy of the automotive world. All of the future lay ahead of him, but somehow he went wrong by his own words, got involved in the desire for massive gain, and in the process lost his wife, his home, and everything. When I read his story, I was on a plane coming down to the last chapters, and the Lord's my witness as I share this to you too. as I finished reading that book and read the last page that I will read to you, it was hard to resist the emotion welling up once again where alienation was so blatantly presented in the closing paragraphs of a life gone wrong. Listen to what he says here. My children still suffer for both my troubles and my problems with their mother. My only hope is that they will grow into adulthood stronger and wiser for what they have experienced. But sadly, they have lost something they can never regain, the youthful innocence and joy we all want our children to experience as long as they can. Not long ago, my son, says DeLorean, Zachary and I were sitting at home. I was reading and he was working on a puzzle. Zachary is always rather contemplative, but on this night he was quieter than usual. I wondered what was bothering him, but before I could ask, he looked at me and said, Dad, why is so much coming down on us and on me? I don't know if I deserve it. I didn't know how to answer him, so I just put my arm around his shoulders and squeezed him close to me. Catherine also has her own private and unanswerable grief. Not long ago, the two of us went out alone for a special Sunday evening father-daughter dinner together at Michael's in Santa Monica. I delighted in my chatty, amusing daughter. It was truly an enchanting evening for me. Toward the end of the dinner, Catherine left the table for a few minutes and the diners next to us introduced themselves to me. They were Mrs. Meredith Wilson, wife of the composer of The Music Man, and well-known musician Nelson Riddle and his wife. Nelson Riddle explained that they had been watching me with my daughter. I never saw two people have a more wonderful and loving time, he said. I have four daughters and I envy you. Somehow I don't think he would have envied me the next evening when my daughter called me in tears. Apparently, Catherine had been thinking all day about our fun evening together, about the fact that her parents now lived apart, that her mother had married another man, and that her young, secure world had been now shattered. What's wrong, honey? Why are you crying? I asked. Oh, Daddy, I had to talk to you. I'm so sad. I saw a commercial on TV that made me cry. It showed a daddy and his little girl holding hands, walking in the woods. The leaves were changing colors, just like when you and I used to walk in the woods and pick flowers, Daddy. It reminded me of a time when we used to be happy. I know those are hard. And if you're living in a situation now where this resonates deeply and wounds even more, my heart goes out to you. I spend a lot of time on the road hearing these, and it is a grievous thing that has come upon us or in society, not always easily explainable. But let me say this. What do the Goulds and the Dawkins have to say to somebody like this? Liberating, free, nothing to truly be concerned about here, no purpose, no higher meaning exists. Chart your own course, move on. Ah, no. The Bible reminds us that when we rejected him, there was a pattern that ensued. And that pattern that came was one of alienation, where there was a fragmentation, where there was a brokenness in every direction. I know you understand the ramifications. It is so visible in our world. But thirdly, then, was domination. The book of Romans tells us how, professing ourselves to be wise, we became fools, and how God gave up such senseless minds to their own folly, and there was an enslavement that ensued. Because time is running out and I want to focus for a few moments in closing, let me just illustrate this and move to my final thought here. One of the privileges of ministry is that you get to meet some of the most wonderful people in the world. Many times people hear us talking of the hurts of travel and they are there. And the rigors of itinerant life, it has been there. In many ways you carry that burden all of your life. But I tell you what, one of the great thrills of being with some of the finest people in the world. I know I have said this before, but as a young teenager when I first came to know the Lord, reading the messages from Moody Founders Week, how would I have ever envisioned the day and the thrill that one day I would be standing behind this sacred pulpit and proclaiming to an audience such as this, the great verities and the grand truths of Christ. The thrill of meeting fellow Christians, or even those who would challenge what you say, but getting to know them. Of all that I have experienced in recent memory, I had a meeting sometime last year. I shall leave the city unnamed. because it was such a private thing for many of them. I was asked to come and speak to a home full of young people who'd gone dreadfully wrong. This was kind of a rehabilitation place for them. They were all addicts of some kind. And I was told when I came there, if there's any horrible addiction you can think of, it will be present in the audience today as these young people listen to you. We're standing in the back watching them. The heaviness of the heart increased because all of them were such deeply addicted to dreadful lifestyles that many of them had become emotional basket cases. And one of the things they had to do to release tension, they were commanded by the leader to literally punch into the air and get rid of all of their anxieties. Can you imagine as a speaker standing at the back of a room looking at a room full of young people just punching into the air and the intensity of their faces? It was sad. Decent homes were represented there. And then they were asked to sit with their palms flat on their legs. They weren't allowed to move. The average person is there for an average length of time of nearly 2 years where they are cut off from so many people that they know. When they arrive there, they are never going to be alone for the first several months. Not when they go to bed, not when they go to the bathroom, not when they go anywhere can they ever be alone because of the addictions that have so enslaved them. And after my talk finished, when I was asked to speak for 1.5 hours and give questions for 2.5 hours, the questions would have been overwhelming to anybody. And then a handsome young man stood up. And he looked at me and he stuttered out his words. He said, "I want to thank you for coming. I don't know how you even were asked to come here, sir. But I want to tell you something. I am a slave. I have blown it." He said, "Sir, can I tell you something frankly in front of all of these teachers and all of my friends here? I cannot look upon a woman without having such heated lust that it is impossible for me to contain it. I have become a slave of my passions. Any time I would have the opportunity to be alone with any member of the opposite sex," he said, "that was the only insatiable desire. And for all these years, that's what I've consumed. I'm empty. I'm burning with a passion, but I do not know how to control it. Can you help me? Can you help me?" And as we try to interact and interact one after another, I wish you could see the letters they sent me. I've shared it with my family because they don't know the people there. Every letter, no matter what it said, ended up by saying one thing. "You mentioned, Mr. Zacharias, that you became a Christian on a bed of suicide. I cannot tell you," one after another they all said, "when I saw you standing up there, a slender hope came up within me. I too maybe can someday be a changed person, and maybe God can do something with my life if he did it with this young man who was on a bed of suicide." Domination. Ah, the domination of the passions that never satisfy. Rejection, alienation, domination, and fourthly, condemnation. That eternal separation that God so warningly reminds us about. However we describe it, I want to tell you what Dostoevsky said about hell, I think is the most painful description that I have heard. He said, "To me, hell would be the inability to love and be loved." The inability to love and be loved. And Dostoevsky's biography testifies why he felt the way he did. He saw so much of hate around him. He thought this is what hell must actually be like. The poet William Auden, his conversion came about from sitting in a theater and watching people scream out for the murder of their enemies. And as he walked out of that Manhattan theater, he not only could not answer what questions came to his mind from seeing such hate, he said, "I couldn't even explain such hate. It was in the mirror of evil that I finally saw the face of God as the only cure for such dominance and such condemnation of the human heart." Rejection, alienation, domination, condemnation. Why, what, and how do we respond to this? You can turn to the pantheistic worldview. There are no answers that deal with such lostness because lostness is not even comprehended. You can turn to the skeptical worldview and there's a triumphalism. This is DNA. This is what it's meant to be. Get rid of the virus because that's what it's all about when we talk about noble thoughts. Ah, but somewhere sandwiched in Holy Writ is this magnificent string of monosyllables. In Luke chapter 19 and verse 10, the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which was lost. The Son of Man came to seek and to save that which was lost. What an extraordinary response to the story of human lostness. Can I bring it to an anchor here? In showing you the heart of God for a fleeting moment and then showing you what can happen to your heart and mine when we respond to this. It was the English poet R.S. Thomas who penned these words. You'll have to listen carefully because they don't flow easily, but artistically they're magnificent. Listen, please. And God held in his hand a small globe. Look, he said. The sun looked. Far off as through water, he saw a scorched land of fierce color. The light burned there. Crusted buildings cast their shadows. A bright serpent, a river uncoiled itself, radiant with slime. On a bare hill, a bare tree saddened the sky. Many people held out their thin arms to it, as though waiting for a vanished April to return to its crossed boughs. The sun watched them. Let me go there, he said. May I repeat that for you? And God held in his hand a small globe. Look, he said. The sun looked. Far off as through water he saw a scorched land of fierce color. The light burned there. Crusted buildings cast their shadows. A bright serpent and a river uncoiled itself, radiant with slime. On a bare hill, a bare tree saddened the sky. Many people held out their thin arms to it, as though waiting for a vanished April to return to its crossed boughs. The sun watched them. Let me go there, he said. The Son of Man came to seek and to save that which was lost. He came into my hospital room in Delhi when I was 17. I don't know where he came to meet you and where you found him. But if you found him, it is because you didn't reject him. You trusted in him. You ended up without alienation then. You ended up with reconciliation. You lost the domination and gained the freedom. You have foregone the condemnation and you have found forgiveness. Trust, reconciliation, freedom, and forgiveness. In my lostness, he takes away the horror of what came upon humanity. I am not wandering around now in some dense fog, wondering if I know who I am or where I am. I have come to the cross and I have understood that this Christ came into this very world with all of the alienation we had and offered forgiveness and reconciliation. In him I have found everything that he created me for. Can I close with this simple illustration? And I think it'll tie it together for you. Last year I happened to be preaching in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, a tough country, by the way, in which to be a follower of Christ. And one of the other speakers told this story, and when he finished again, I felt I really ought not to stand up and preach a message because you could just sense as though God had brought the weight of his power and conviction through that simple little story. And my challenge was then not to take the next 45 minutes and ruin what God had already done. It was so simple, and to my Eastern mind it registered so clearly. You may have heard it, but it's a powerful little anecdote. May I share it with you? It's told of a man who was very wealthy and had some of the world's most beautiful paintings. He was a lover of great art. And he had this art gallery in his home where people would come and enjoy this artistic display. And they admired his tastes and all that he was doing for the world of the artist. And they would spend hours looking at these pieces of art. His son was a very kindly disposed young man, blessed by his father's wealth. He would walk occasionally into the parts of town that were not so well-to-do, where people were more deprived and living in rather decrepit conditions. And the son engaged a friendship with a beggar on the side of the road and became quite close to him, and would come regularly, talk to the beggar, and they would converse now as they began to know each other well. And the beggar learned of his father's affection for art. But as some years went by, the son very tragically and suddenly passed away. All people were coming to give their condolences. The beggar also came and asked if he could come into this home. And he looked at the man and he said, "Sir, you don't know me, but your son was very kind to me. Gave me a lot of the money that helped me to cope with my poverty. And I know how grieved you must be as a dad, because I am brokenhearted over the death of a fine young man like that." He said, "Sir, I know you love the great pieces of art. I am not an artist, but I've got myself a paper and a pencil, and I have drawn a picture of your son, the way I always pictured him to be, in his gentleness, in his kindness. And I want to give you this portrait I have drawn of how I remember your son." The father was grateful, took it, and kept it with him. It was not much of a piece of art, but the father appreciated what it symbolized. Some years went by, and the father himself passed away. And in the estate, all of these paintings were going to be auctioned off. And the auctioneer came, and all of those who loved art came to bid on these paintings. And as they gathered and were surveying all these paintings, right in the middle was one that didn't fit. It was this what this beggar had done, and the father had framed it and put it right in the middle there. And as they looked around, nobody paused to look at that one. They were looking at all of the expensive pieces of art. Finally, the gavel of the auctioneer pounded, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, there was a desire expressed by the owner of all these paintings that the first painting to be auctioned here was the one right in the middle there." And he pointed to the one that the beggar had done. And there were moans and groans, and nobody really wanted to bid, but the beggar happened to be there. And he said, "I have some money here, it's all I have. I'm willing to offer that for the painting of that one right in the middle there." And as the auctioneer took the money, he traded that, drawing actually of the beggar, and gave it to him. And somebody shouted, "Let's get on now with the real pieces of art here." And the auctioneer pounded his gavel once again, and he said, "No, behind that piece of art were these words, 'Whoever bids for this one gets the rest of them too.'" I tell you what, when you come to the Son and trust in Him, that lostness is changed into being found. Like the father who stood at the doorway as his son came towards the in the distance, and the father lifted the garments to his knees there and ran as fast as he could. "This my son who was lost is now found, who was dead is now alive." You have a choice: rejecting his word, which follows with alienation, domination, and condemnation, or trusting in him. And you find the reconciliation that He gives to you, the freedom that He brings in your innermost being, and the forgiveness that you will find. I want you to know, reading the Goulds and the Dawkins, I know where the good news is, and I am glad I have given my life over to that news. Once was lost, but now is found.
You've been listening to Founders Week 1999 from the Moody Bible Institute. For more information about Founders Week or other radio programs on cassette, call the Moody Cassette Ministry at 1-800-626-1224.